This program is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Network, a world leader in talk radio since 1998. Visit GCNlive.com today.
You can stick it to the man and big tech. Join our FTL social mastodon at social.freetalklive.com.
What's up, all of our liberty-loving friends? Once again, another fantastic episode of Liberty at Night with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network, coming at you from Nashville, Tennessee. Every Tuesday night, you can find us on Liberty at Night on the Free Talk Live Network, wherever it is that you're listening to us right now. Maybe it's on the Free Talk Live podcast channel, or maybe you're listening somewhere on a highway on the radio station. I don't know. But if you wanted to know... And we also go by another name, and me and Charlie, we go by another name called Good Morning Liberty. On Good Morning Liberty, we talk life, liberty, and the pursuit of meaning. That's our tagline. Pretty cool, right? Every single day of the week when we want to. That's right, almost every single day of the week. You can get a brand new episode delivered straight to your phone. 1,193 episodes so far. That's a lot of episodes. So we cover the news every single day of the week when we want to, because sometimes we don't want to, and that's fine. We're libertarians. It means we don't have to do it. No one's forcing us to do it. And so if you feel the same way, then you want to go find us. And by the way, you can join what we call the Fed Haters Club. Those are the people that subscribe and they hang out live in our private Discord channel every day of the week. When we do an episode, we go live, and you can chat back and forth with us. We'll talk to you during the show. You get a shout-out, stuff like that. You can suggest topics and correct us if we ever say anything wrong. Good luck trying to find that, you know. But anyway, you want to make sure you go to joingmail.com for that. Like I said, it's Good Morning Liberty with Nate and Charlie. And Charlie is not here right now, but I am joined by Mr. Isaac Willauer, who's a senior at Grove City College and a journalist focusing on race culture and American conservatism. Isaac, how you doing?
Hey, Nate, how you doing? Thanks for having me on the show, man.
I'm glad you're here. I'm excited to talk about this. Now, for some of our listeners who might not have heard of you before or seen you before, why don't you give us a little bit of your backstory? Like, what brought you to where you are right now? Every single important event that happened in your life, if you could sum that up in like less than a minute.
45 seconds.
Yeah. How did you get
we'll
here?
Do that. No, fantastic. Yeah. No. So I was born in India. I was adopted at a year and a half, and I've lived in America for last summer was 20 years. So that's a fun little milestone. I'm a senior at Grove City College in Western Pennsylvania. I study political science and psychology. I'm a journalist. I've covered issues from war in Ukraine to the death row in Florida. And as of recently, I've kind of taken a deeper dive into issues of race, conservatism, and a lot of that, obviously, as we're going to talk about, has morphed into some pretty outspoken criticism of the DEI lobby, that kind of thing. So that's where I found myself right now.
Yeah, so you had an article that was published by the Daily Wire, so congrats on that. That's a big deal. Fairly big publication, from my understanding, so congrats.
It
was called Three Things My Future Children Need to Know About Race. And obviously, DEI is a really big topic right now. Sometimes I think it's too big of a topic, but, you know, it's something that a lot of people are talking about for sure. So I was gonna try and get your stance on, like, if you think there's good things about this DEI push or this DEI culture right now, and then we'll get into the bad stuff also.
Yeah, no, for sure. So that's a really good way to kick things off. So I obviously am conservative, right? I'm not white, obviously. And so this kind of gives me a unique angle into the way DEI works. And I know there are a lot of people who just absolutely straight up, just across the board, there's nothing good about DEI. And I mean, I think in terms of a lot of the modern iterations of it, we can probably make that case, right? It's doing more harm than good. I think we can have that case. Now, I think in theory, and I've interviewed DEI practitioners before, I think in theory there probably is a helpful way to do DEI in terms of, like, what DEI basically does is it looks for, whether it's in a business or it's in a college or anywhere else, is it looks for racial disparities and looks for explanations for those disparities. On its face, that's pretty innocuous, right? Like, that's a perfectly legitimate goal. It's where it goes from there and the answers that it comes up with that are problems. So I think, is it possible for a school, a business, a college to do to just be data driven in that way, and to just focus on, and to just be meritocratically focused and also do DEI. Do I think that's possible in theory? Of course it's possible in theory. My concern is not only that a lot of times it doesn't happen that way in practice, but people are, even DEI practitioners are disincentivized from practicing it that way, right? So there's a right way to do it that's very data focused in this kind of thing and aimed at increasing workplace cohesion. But then there's the really, really, really popular version of it that does none of those things and tends to divide people and tends to focus on buzzwords as opposed to actual business function. I think that's where the problem lies.
Now, some of the criticisms of DEI, of course, I mean, I have some, probably the same as you. I tend to support just a merit-based system, like that's the system I want to go towards. And if you happen to have that DEI department, they find, well, people are getting held out, and it's because of some kind of racism or something like that.
Yeah.
I think that that's clearly that is a good thing. The biggest criticism would be, could you be holding out other people that might be better on the merit? I don't know. Now, the other thing I want to ask you is this anti-DEI push. Have you seen instances where it has actually gone too far?
Oh, yeah. No, 100%. I mean, I'm trying to think of a good. Okay, so the best corporate example I can think of right now is Chick-fil-A, right? So Chick-fil-A has a DEI office, and that's, and people raise just an absolute hue and cry about this is the worst thing ever. And this business, which has been a stalwart conservative business for a very long time, has been the evangelical favorite. Now they have a DEI office. We can't support them, boycott, run screaming into a wall, which is always a great strategy, right? I think, and I looked into that, and when you read the DEI page of a place like Chick-fil-A, it's not DEI in the way that we currently understand it, right? Chick-fil-A is doing, as is the case with many things in business, Chick-fil-A is doing things very differently than a lot of modern businesses, right? It's about creating an environment that's welcoming to people of all cultures, this kind of thing. If that was what all DEI was, we would not be sitting here having this conversation about DEI. It's quite simple, and there wouldn't be this massive cultural pushback. So yeah, can anti-DEI people shoot too quickly, get the wrong target? Is that possible? Of course it's possible. It happens all the time. But that doesn't mean that the criticisms of much of the modern kind of pop DEI lobby are misplaced, I think.
One instance where I get really annoyed is we had this rash of issues that happened in the airline industry and the FAA, stuff like that. And this is around the same time I think the big anti-DEI push was happening. And then if I just paid attention to what people were tweeting or posting on X, it would seem like every problem that happened was caused because DEI forced the company to hire a minority over the higher merit-based white person who didn't get the job, and therefore the door fell off the plane or something like that.
Yeah, 100%.
And, you know, and so every single thing that happens, like, well, this is what happens when you have DEI. And I'm like, I feel like you need to examine every single instance and figure out what actually happened. You know, maybe someone just did a bad job that day and it's not because of DEI programs, you know,
and that's a perfectly, and the whole door seal thing. I mean, that's a meritocratic argument. It doesn't matter what race you are. The door fell off the plane. I mean, come on. It doesn't matter if it was a white person or a black person. That is just, it should be a not at Boeing person. That should be the rule that we should be looking for. So yeah, I think we can definitely see excesses, and we shouldn't tolerate those excesses or act like they're okay in pursuance of a broader cultural goal. But I think, and the point I made in the Daily Wire piece is that much of modern DEI is not animated solely by a practice, but by a philosophy, and a philosophy of skepticism about America's ability to do racial reconciliation, and a profoundly pessimistic narrative about our ability to coexist as people of different ethnicities, which I think is really pernicious and toxic.
Yeah, this, you know, I was going to mention, like, I was kind of raised with the idea that you, this, it feels weird to say it, but that you this idea that you don't see people's races and skin colors and ethnicities, and that you treat everyone just like they're a human being with life experiences like you, and we all have these life experiences, and that's made us the person that we are right now. And it kind of seems like that idea right now makes me racist, possibly, for saying that. But one of these things that you listed in the piece was that you didn't want to go through life viewing everything through a racial lens, that wasn't the right way, that wasn't the way that you wanted to do it. So I don't know if you got any ideas on that.
Yeah, no, that's very true. It's a very interesting point, because it's like, basically, I was raised more or less the same. It's in terms of, obviously, there are times when we need to see race, because when issues of racial preference or prejudice are being brought up, obviously we need to look at race and see what's going on there. That's not when people say they don't see race. I think a lot of people who are maybe more on the anti-racist pro-DEI train, when they hear people say they don't see race, they take that to mean, well, you're just ignorant to racism, right? You're just ignoring the epidemic of white supremacy. That's not what it means at all, right? In a charitable reading of that, what that means is, and in my opinion, generally it's the right reading of that, it means that I don't view life primarily or even really secondarily through racial lenses. I see them through moral and philosophical and human lenses. I spent some time, especially like a little bit in high school, thinking about life through maybe a more racial lens than I do now. And I will tell you, it didn't exactly do wonders for my mental health. It doesn't exactly do you any great service to sit around thinking about all the ways in which you're different from everybody else around you. Turns out that's never really a helpful way to view life. And it makes you more depressed. And I will say, this is no offense to some of the DEI practitioners that I've interviewed, because some of them are wonderful people. They clearly care about meritocratic things. I think they're misled, but I think they care. But a lot of people I know who are very on board with the DEI machine, very on board with the anti-racism train, right? Their outlooks on life, I hear them explain their outlooks on life, and they're so depressing. They're so pessimistic. And I'm like, is this what we're supposed to sell young Americans, especially Americans of color? Like, I don't want my future son or daughter to bump into any of these people, because it's just going to depress and annoy them. I think we can do better than that. And I think that is the really pernicious thing about DEI right now, is that it's rooted in that sentiment of skepticism about whether or not America is actually great, skepticism about whether or not America can actually work for people of all colors. We have come so far as a nation. Is this really the time for skepticism on this issue? I don't think so. And skepticism where it is not warranted is a very, very quick path to nihilism, I think.
Before we go any further, I got to tell y'all, I messed up. I started a savings account a few years ago. I put $5,000 in it, and I never looked at it again. I don't even know why. That $5,000, because of inflation, is now worth $4,145. That's not good. The government punishes you for keeping your wealth, your money, your cash in the savings account. How? That's through inflation. Inflation is a tax on savers. It's a systematic erosion of your wealth. Items that cost $10 today might cost $15 tomorrow, but your savings account will still have the same amount of money in it, meaning it's losing purchasing power. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They've secured over $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. This is exciting because gold can be a hedge against inflation. Gold remains steady when inflation's on the rise. The dollar's in turmoil. Gold can be defense against economic downturn. Unlike money, gold can't be printed. It's your shield in times of economic uncertainty. Gold's value doesn't just hold, it increases during inflationary periods. To find out more, go to noblegoldinvestments.com/GML. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/GML.
Well, yeah, I mean, I tried to imagine being told as I was growing up that it didn't matter what I did, that society was going to hold me back and I wouldn't be able to make it anywhere. Like, why would you ever try after that? Like, it seems like a self-perpetuating cycle of keeping people down by just telling them that there's no point in even trying because the system's going to hold you down, right?
Yeah, well, then let's also take a look at who are the people that the DEI lobby is really rallying behind right now. Claudine Gay, really? She's the person. Like, I don't want my daughter to be told you can be just like Claudine Gay. call me crazy, that is not a helpful thing to tell anybody, especially if she's going to college. That's going to be a real problem. It's, I don't want, the DEI lobby, unfortunately, has a habit, I'm not going to say everybody does it, has a habit of picking the worst role models, like Claudine Gay, and holding them up as examples either of virtuous resistance to the system or as virtuous victims to the system. And I'm sorry, is Claudine Gay the best that we have? Really? I don't think so. And I think that that needs to be dealt with.
One thing I really worry about, and this really comes from all sides, a lot of it from the anti-DEI side too, is that ideas like this, I'm worried, can actually lead to more racism, where I felt like we were on a really good path as a country throughout my lifetime. And when you have things like a DEI push and a hiring program and the idea, I'm not even saying that it specifically is happening, but the idea pushed out to people that you're going to hire someone because of their race and not hire someone else because of their race, that we're going to lead to a more racist society where you have, like, going back to the airline thing, people saying, oh, if I go into an airplane and I see the pilots are black, I'm getting off of there. And that's not the direction that we want to go. And unfortunately, that's what happens when you don't, when you don't have a purely merit-based system. You know, you fear those kind of things. When I walk onto a plane and I see the pilots are black and I'm like, okay, well, you have a purely merit-based system. That means that they beat out all of the other candidates that they are and they're the best possible pilots. But when that creeps into your mind that, well, what if they're hired because they're black?
I mean, it's socially corrosive on both ends, right? So it's socially corrosive on your end seeing that, because if you, not you, but like you generally, if people start thinking that way, that is a woe to all of the qualified black airline pilots. Oh my goodness. What does this do for you? It's because one thing, it destroys your customers' confidence in you, but also kind of destroys your own ability to be confident in yourself. Because not only do you have to ask yourself, oh my gosh, maybe I did get this position because I'm black, but you then have to also ask yourself, wait, does everybody think that I got this position because I'm black? It is unfortunately, like, we have enough problems with imposter syndrome of people who want to do better, right? We don't need to be compounding it by giving people the notion that maybe everything you accomplish in your life is due to your skin color. Maybe that's what it is. Oh, and also, by the way, everything bad that you encounter in your life is also because of your skin color. So, like, have fun with that. These are profoundly soul-destroying ideas. They are very, very, to use the social science term, stupid. They don't help anybody. And I look at this, and the reason I titled the Daily Wire piece the thing that I did was because I hear all the time, and I get MSNBC and the Boston Globe are the two pieces I linked in the article, this assumption that people who are anti-DEI are doing this out of some kind of racial animus, or because we are all white supremacists, or because we all love the Klan, or because we all want to hold black Americans down and hold Americans of color down and act as if the 1950s, the bad parts, or the 1850s, the bad parts, are the times that we want to return to. This is nonsense, right? We are critiquing DEI because it doesn't help us. We are critiquing DEI because we care about future generations of Americans of color, and we're concerned about the influence of well-intentioned but profoundly misled Americans who are going to tell them that focusing on race and racial differences is the way to become a happier, healthier person. It doesn't. We're not doing this out of some kind of animus. We're doing this because we care. We're doing this because we care about the future of America. And we care about the story that we're telling other people, not only about America, but the story that they will then tell themselves. It behooves us to give them a good story, because it is a good story in many, many important ways.
So what should we do then, or what should corporations do? What should people in power do to fix this problem? Like, I don't think that you want to get rid of, you know, all DEI that there is out there.
No,
at least on its original
idea. Although
Ben
Sasse's little test run at University of Florida, we get to see how that goes. So I'm sure that'll turn up some interesting test cases. I'm not going to opine about that, but yeah, I don't want to ban it outright. I don't think that's necessarily the way. I think it's, because that involves federal government action, which are just terrible words, just in general. And And I think that kind of decision should be left up to, if you're a business and you truly believe that there's a, that you can do DEI right, I go for it, man. I got no problem with that. I don't care. Now if you do it wrong, I mean, you deserve to be ridiculed and made fun of and probably lose money for it, but that's another issue. I think in terms of what can people do, I mean, one, hold DEI people accountable. So there's this whole snafu in Oklahoma with where Governor Stitt signs this order saying that banning certain forms of DEI. Nicole Hannah-Jones said it was racist. Basically, what this Oklahoma order did was say that you cannot call for preferential treatment based on race. That is not a controversial ask. That is an ask that every DEI office in the country should be able to comply with and should already be complying with. And if that elicits pushback, the question then becomes, why? Why are you pushing back to that? You can't be racist. Why are you upset that you can't be racist? Oh, that's not good. So there's that, right? I think when it comes to governmental action, that kind of thing, I think is perfectly fine. I have no problem with that. I think that is perfectly in keeping with the character of American law and in the character of the American experiment. That makes sense. So that's what corporations can do, is they can root out all preferential treatment of race of any kind, right? Which is what we want, which is what meritocracy really is. But I think at the more individual level, I mean, we need to be very discerning with the narratives on race that we send to people, right? We need to be very careful that we're not ignoring America's historical sins. We're not trying to create historical curriculums that erase such things. But we also need to not tell everybody that America is a terrible racist country. There is in fact a wide spectrum between those two things. There's absolutely no reason. Like, I had someone ask me just the other day, who's like a DEI advocate, right? And they asked me, you know, you have to choose between teaching systemic racism and teaching white supremacy. I'm like, are those my only options? Really? They're not my only options, it turns out. And our future generations of Americans deserve better than that kind of reductionist, simplistic, stupid, anti-racist dichotomy.
I completely agree. And I think that's a good place for us to end it, because you just gave people a lot of good things to think about. Unless you have something else you want to add on this, but that felt pretty good to me.
Yeah, no, that's great.
All right.
This is the message that Americans need to hear.
Good, good. So, Isaac, where can people go to find more of your work?
Yeah, so go to youngvoices.org. If you want to follow me specifically, I'm on Twitter at ISAACWILLOUR, or on X. Sorry, it's not Twitter anymore.
Can we all agree to revolt against that and just call it Twitter, you think? I mean, that's what we can all agree on.
I'm never going to call it an X. I'm never going to call it an X post. That's creepy and weird.
Yeah, it's really weird. You should never change the name of something that's been turned into a verb. You know, that's true.
Tweets are fun. Posts are boring.
Yeah, that sounds really boring. All right, Isaac, come on anytime. You know, send me an email. This is a great conversation, and we'd love to have you back.
Absolutely, Nate. Thanks so much. God bless.
Okay, coming right up, we're going to be talking about AI, the dangers, the benefits. Are we all going to get killed by AI? I don't know. Mr. Benjamin Ianian is going to be talking to us coming right up. Then we'll do Dumb Bleep of the Week on Liberty Tonight on the Free Talk Live Network.
Hi, I'm Dan Pilla. I started fighting the IRS over 40 years ago when they tried to seize my mother's house. I sued the IRS and won. I beat the IRS then, and I've been beating them ever since. I wrote the book on tax debt settlement, and I've helped thousands of people deal with tax problems they thought might never be solved. I can help you too. If you owe taxes you can't pay, don't wait another day. There's no such thing as a hopeless tax case. Call 800-34-NO-TAX or go to my website, danpilla.com. That's danpilla.com, danpilla.com.
G'day, I'm Jamel that works with Dr. Joel Wallach and the GCN team with Youngevity at teamg'day.com. By becoming an associate, you provide income for you and your family on your own hours while working from home. So contact me, Jamel, by filling in the contact box at teamg'day.com, and I will get back to you personally and provide all the support you need to get started and build your Youngevity business. Teamg'day.com. Teamg'day.com.
USA USA News Update. The Supreme Court has extended a temporary halt on Texas's immigration law, which permits state law enforcement to arrest and detain individuals suspected of entering the country unlawfully. Initially scheduled to take effect on Wednesday, the High Court extended the pause to further review challenges to the law. A former Mar-a-Lago employee and witness in former President Trump's classified documents case is speaking on the record. Brian Butler spoke to CNN, detailing how he unwittingly moved boxes in 2022 containing classified material from Mar-a-Lago to Trump's private plane on the same day Trump was set to meet with Justice Department officials back at the resort. A top official from the National Institute on Drug Abuse is urging Americans to pay attention to the types of cannabis products teenagers are using following a recent study revealing high school seniors are using Delta 8, a psychoactive substance. John Schaefer, USA News.
Stop aging now. Restore those joints. Boost your strength. Because it's official. NutraMedical has released the most exciting, powerful anti-aging supplement on the market. Dr. Bill Deagle's Red Deer Velvet DR has been approved by the U.S. Patent Office. Imagine stem cell rejuvenation all in one capsule without huge expense. Dr. Bill MD discovered that as an unborn baby grows in the mother's womb, he or she does not deteriorate or physically age. Red Deer Velvet DR, like the uterus, provides 300 biomolecules and 6 hormones protected in one special DR capsule that delivers lipid packages directly into your circulation. This patented technology bypasses the stomach and is released into the small bowel unaltered by digestive enzymes and stomach acid. Remember, Red Deer Velvet DR. Improve endurance, stimulate your immune system, increase learning ability, and even improve sexual libido with Red Deer Velvet DR. Click NutriMedical.com. That's NutriMedical.com. Or call toll-free 888-212-8871 and get on the road to a newer, rejuvenated, happier you.
I need to do my taxes. Are there any self-help options online?
Doing taxes yourself? IRS.gov has many self-service tax tools, and they're all just a click away. Prepare and file your taxes online using FreeFile. Use our calculator to estimate your tax withholding. Order a tax transcript. Apply for an employer identification number. Check your refund status, too. IRS.gov, your 24/7 federal tax resource.
We depend on our drinking water supply daily, but where does that water come from? Your water provider encourages you to get to know your local water source so together we can protect and preserve it. The investments we make as a community to protect our water source now ensure we have a sustainable drinking water supply for the future. Visit drinktap.org to learn more. This message is brought to you by the American Water Works Association and your local water provider.
Appreciate what we do? Help us advertise, market, and promote for just $5 a month at amp.freetalklive.com.
If Liberty Unite with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network, we're going to do this interview here with Benjamin Aniam. We're going to talk about AI and taxes. So anyway, man, we got a couple articles here in the stack to talk about. The first one has to do with AI, and I wanted to ask you this pressing question. I'm worried about it. Is AI going to kill us all?
No, I certainly don't think AI is going to kill us all. I do understand the concerns, especially because, you know, this is a new technology. Whenever we see, you know, new technologies being developed, it's very normal to see the citizenry react with fear and come up with these hypothetical situations, these doomsday scenarios. And one that we see a lot is what you just mentioned, is that AI is going to kill us all. We're going to go extinct as a result of these different models. And I think that Mark Andreessen, who's a very, you know, well-renowned venture capitalist, a very successful guy, he wrote a great piece that I would recommend people look up about AI last year. And there's a quote that I just want to read from that real quick. He wrote, AI is math, code, computers. It's built by people, owned by people, used by people, controlled by people. The idea that it will at some point develop a mind of its own and decide that it has motivations that lead it to try to kill us is a superstitious hand wave. And I think that that really hits the nail on the head. You know, it's software built on top of hardware, made by humans. We're the ones that control it. I don't foresee it causing a mass extinction event.
Okay, I feel better now. I watched Terminator a bunch of times when I was growing up, and so, you know, I've always been worried about this inevitable
machine takeover, but if you say so, I'll go ahead and place that one on the back burner to the a more pressing question, the more down to earth question that we hear, which is that AI is going to lead to mass unemployment. It's going to steal everyone's jobs. Is that something that people should be worried about with AI?
Yeah, that's always a concern. The transition from a place of, you know, status quo or current day, you know, the transition to a new world with some revolutionary technology, the transition can be bumpy. You know, there are going to be people that lose their jobs during that transition. But what we've seen throughout history is that technological development has been able to increase prosperity, increase job growth over time. As of now, I don't think we have any reason to believe that artificial intelligence will be any different. And fears of unemployment have been unemployment resulting from technological development. Specifically, those fears have been around since technological development has been around. You know, I also recommend people take a look at, there's a page on the Cato Institute website, which is a libertarian think tank, as I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of. Jeffrey Muron has a great page where he lists, you know, quotes and examples of all different types of fears relating to unemployment from technology all throughout history, stemming back from, as far back as I believe, you know, maybe 700 AD, I think is as far back as his list goes. It might even be sooner, but there have been Roman emperors who quashed various technological developments for fear of unemployment. There's actually one that he points to. A Roman emperor ordered that an inventor be killed because he was fearful his invention would cause unemployment. We've seen, you know, queens of England do the same thing. One more, you know, good example, I think, is in 1989, the International Metal Workers Federation actually predicted that within 30 years, as little as 2% of all of the current labor force would be needed to produce all goods and services necessary. Well, we are far past 30 years since that prediction, and the global unemployment rate is in the single digits. So I don't think we have any reason to think that AI will be any different, but I definitely understand those fears a little bit more.
One thing that only ever leads me to fear things like this is the environment that makes it more difficult for new industries to pop up. You know, that's something that you would really want when AI does come in and replace some workers in some specific industry, is that you want it to be as easy as possible for new jobs to be created and a new industry to be created. And the more we, the more regulations and laws that we have that make that more difficult, the closer we get to the situation that people are afraid of, right?
I think you just hit the nail on the head. People should be more worried about government policy and regulations that restrict the growth of the economy and of business creation than they should be about technological innovation. You know, we shouldn't have crippling regulations, unnecessary compliance costs, you know, put on, you know, possible new entrants into various fields. That's what slows down job growth. That's exactly what makes the transition with revolutionary technology more difficult. Our energy should be focused on repealing unnecessary regulations and freeing up our economy so that we can have that job growth that results from this innovation.
Now, one thing that I honestly had not thought about at all until I read your piece in realclearenergy.org is the environmental impacts of AI. I didn't even know that there was such a thing. I guess now that I think about it, there would be a lot of energy consumed from the companies that are making these products. But what are people saying about that right now?
Yeah, there's been a lot of concern with environmental impacts from artificial intelligence. And, you know, it, just as you said, you know, the more compute that there is out in the world, the more energy usage that, you know, we'll see, at least in the immediate future. And so people have been really worried about CO2 emissions as they're related to this technology. Now, you know, we've also seen that with other new technologies. You know, for example, Bitcoin, you know, people were really worried that Bitcoin mining was going to cause massive, you know, CO2 emissions. And we've actually seen, you know, various reports by, you know, massive even consulting firms talking about how Bitcoin can be great for the environment, can help, you know, the development of renewable energy. And so I think artificial intelligence kind of falls into that category. There's a lot of early fear. And I think over time, we're going to see that A, on net, it's going to be good for the environment, but also that even in the short term, it's not as bad for the environment as everyone is worrying. And so, you know, what we're seeing right now is people trying to study the CO2 emissions as they are linked to model development and model usage. And so one example that a recent report by the Center for Data Innovation highlighted was a research report at the University of Massachusetts Amherst that estimated, you know, that that training a specific model that they looked at would generate about 626,000 pounds of CO2. They were looking at a model that would help with, I believe it was English to German translations and vice versa. But anyway, that amount of CO2 is comparable to around 300 round-trip flights from the East to West Coast. And the developers of this model saw these, you know, calculations, these estimations, and in response, they decided to, you know, release a summary of their energy use and really detail their work how much energy they were using as a result of it. And it turns out that the actual emissions from training that model were about 88 times smaller than the estimates reported by the team at University of Massachusetts Amherst. So that's just one example that it's really hard to get good data on, you know, the energy usage of different models, especially when you're estimating from the outside. So I think we need to be careful about letting these different reports, especially, you know, ones coming from think tanks, universities, where they're doing these estimations from the outside. You know, we have to question how good is their data, because it's really hard to estimate the impact of these things.
I'm just shocked right now that there was a model that was created that ended up being wrong as it pertains to CO2 emissions. I didn't know that you were such a climate denier. I don't know if we can talk about these kinds of things on here. The other thing, you know, you mentioned that there would be innovations and new efficiencies, and actually, couldn't AI help create some of those things? I mean, maybe there is a whole other way of generating energy that this mythical computer is just going to come up with for us. I don't know. Maybe I'm reaching a little bit there, but it would be kind of ironic if we ended up stopping ourselves from creating energy innovations that could help solve the climate crisis that people are trying to prevent.
Yeah, over time, you know, there's two prongs really to answering that question. First is the efficiency of AI models themselves. You know, over time, we can expect the efficiency of these models to improve, which we've already been seeing. You know, even when they're growing in size and complexity, the rate of their energy consumption is not necessarily growing at the same rate as the models themselves. And over time, we should see better efficiency related to the hardware that's involved in actually creating these models, and so on top of seeing better efficiency with the models themselves, we also can expect that AI will help us solve environmental challenges. They can analyze large sets of data, you know, far better than the technology that we've had in the past. So that can help us conserve water, that can help us combat huge crises like wildfires. It can help us optimize our energy usages in a lot of ways by analyzing, you know, the current systems that we employ. And so the ability to analyze large sets of data and really sift through information much quicker could theoretically help us improve the environment. So I actually don't think that's theoretical at all. We're already seeing it. And so I think people need to take that into account when they're worrying about the environmental impact of AI. AI could help us drastically improve our environmental impact.
Now, one thing before we move on and take a hard shift over to California and wealth taxes, before we move on, the scariest thing in AI that I've seen so far was that Google Gemini thing. I mean, that's actually the closest thing to destroying society I've seen so far. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that was definitely a bit concerning, seeing how much bias was baked into that model. And that is a real concern I think people need to think about with AI, specifically LLMs. There's a huge conflation, or I guess not necessarily conflation, but AI is used as this umbrella term that people just assume are LLMs that we use every day, because that's what the average day consumer comes into contact with. It's ChatGPT, it's Gemini, it's, you know, Grok, it's things of that nature. But, you know, AI is not just LLMs, but the LLMs that we use, we really do need to be mindful of because they are created by humans. They are baked in, you know, they do have the bias baked in of the people who create them. And so the biggest risk that I see from, you know, the consumer focused, chatbot models is people ascribing a, you know, godlike presence to these models where they just believe what's spit out to them, where they buy whatever it tells them, whatever answer it gives them has to be the holy grail. I think we need to continue to be skeptical of the answers we receive, just like we are when we Google something online. You click on the first article that pops up, you're not going to immediately believe what it tells you. You might ask follow-up questions. You might research a little bit more, see what other, you know, viewpoints there are out there. And so I think we need to maintain that healthy skepticism of the information we receive, even from large LLMs. And I think that Gemini was, you know, provided a great example that when you would type in you know, the name of founding father and you'd want a picture of George Washington, he might come out black. Or you might type in, you know, the name of some other historical figure who was black or white or whatever, and they might come out Asian. So they're definitely, it's a bit of a ridiculous example because I don't think anyone would have predicted that it would be that far off, but it's a great reminder that these models are still fallible, just like the human beings that program them.
I think a great thing to take away from it was that the market actually worked. You know, Google pulled that Gemini feature of making those photos, and they have enough competition in the market that everyone knew that it was completely ridiculous and that they weren't going to use it to generate their photos. And they're going to be extremely skeptical of the answers it's giving because we have so much great competition, other options out there that we can go to. So that's I think that's a win for the market.
Absolutely. You know, consumer pressure, you know, consumer feedback at the end of the day will direct what companies do with their products. And if a product is so biased that it becomes unusable, it's not going to survive in the market. And so over time, hopefully these different LLMs or, you know, image generators will become better because people want, you know, consumers to be able to use them gainfully.
Now, the next topic here, if we got enough time to do that, if you're okay with that, is this California wealth tax idea. Now, they got a $68 billion, potential $68 billion deficit. I'm confused because I thought they had a massive surplus like last year, and now they have a giant deficit, and people are kicking around the idea of a wealth tax, I guess. What's going on there?
Yeah, the deficit was a bit of a surprise for some. There's been a huge revenue shortfalls in the state, and they spend like drunken sailors, you know, much like our federal government does in a lot of ways. So in that context, you know, staring down this possibly huge budget deficit in the upcoming year, the California legislature was set to discuss the possibility of implementing a wealth tax. Now, thankfully, the bill that was being discussed ended up stalling in committee after Gavin Newsom, surprise, surprise, actually came out strongly in opposition to the bill. However, it still should worry us that these conversations continue to pop up. You know, it's not going anywhere. California will discuss it again at some time soon. Maybe Gavin Newsom, if he's not eyeing the presidency a little bit out of the corner of his eye, maybe he won't be so quick to oppose a wealth tax in the future. You never know when the political landscape can change. So we definitely need to be cognizant of this possibility because it's going to pop up at the federal level as, you know, you see federal politicians bring up the possibility of a wealth tax all the time. So it's definitely something that needs to be discussed.
I don't think Gavin Newsom would ever go with it because he tends to do the bidding of his friends and his family in the legislature. So I'm guessing that had something to do with him being against this idea. How impractical is a wealth tax to actually implement? Some people think that you're just going to look at a piece of paper. It says how much wealth there is, and then you're going to put a tax on that person. Here's how much they owe you, but it's not quite like that, right?
A wealth tax is highly impractical. It's incredibly hard to implement, and the state that implements it will incur huge administrative costs because there are going to be disputes between the wealthy and the tax collectors about the valuation of their assets. And to value assets that aren't publicly traded, it's much harder. You know, it's not just valuing stock, okay? You pull up, the S&P 500, and you can figure out how much they're holding in the S&P 500 is worth. That's pretty easy. But when we're talking about shares in private companies, or we're talking about art or boats or homes, those things are not as easily valued. And there's going to be disputes, between what is reported and what the tax collectors think that should have been reported. And so it costs a lot of money to value these assets and to collect the taxes associated with them. And then on top of it being impractical, it's also terrible for the economy. When you tax something, you disincentivize that thing. We see politicians try and tax nicotine because they don't want people smoking cigarettes as much. Now, that just drives it underground. It becomes a black market. It doesn't necessarily get rid of it, but it does disincentivize some people from engaging in that activity. When you raise the cost of something, the demand for it, goes down, at least marginally. So it's going to disincentivize wealth creation. It's also going to incentivize people to leave whatever state implements it. We've seen this all throughout, the last 100 years. There used to be about 4 times as many European countries who had wealth taxes as they do now. Most of them got rid of them because they're hard to implement. The wealthy left and their countries became poorer. So it really is not only impractical, it's also terrible from a consequentialist standpoint. It harms the economy within the area that it's implemented.
The other thing that you make a point to mention, which is the point of the article, which I love, is that it's also immoral, which is something that we lose sight of sometimes. We can talk all day about how this wouldn't be able to work, about how it wouldn't be implemented. That leaves open the idea that if the right person got an office and you hired the right people to do this for you, that then it would be a good idea. But it's also still immoral.
Exactly. So it's impractical. It's also bad for economic growth, bad for jobs. We just talked about artificial intelligence. Well, if you want job growth, you should oppose a wealth tax because you don't want productive members of society leaving because they are avoiding the tax. Job growth will suffer. But we shouldn't only look at the consequences of this policy. We should actually look at it based on principle as well. And so in my article, I take the stance that it is immoral to implement a wealth tax. And I really looked at the California situation for a couple of reasons. So one, a wealth tax violates this notion of the rule of law that we have, that no policy should work to the detriment of a specific group or for the benefit of a specific group. Laws should be neutral on their face. They should not be working to engender certain social outcomes, let's say, for particular groups. That is not, the proper role of the government. So it violates the rule of law. That's one way in which it violates morality. And then it's also wrong to employ coercion to take citizens' property when there are completely viable alternatives. Now, as a libertarian, I believe in the saying that taxation is theft. But I'm a libertarian. I'm not an anarchist. So I do recognize there's going to be some level of taxation. But the idea that taxation is theft means the threshold that has to be met for it to be justified is incredibly high. And so when there are very viable alternatives to taking citizens' money to fix, let's say, a budget deficit in California, that's when it becomes deeply immoral to employ coercion to take that money. And, so a lot of people ask, well, how is it coercive? Well, all taxes are backed by the implicit threat of violence, imprisonment, or fines. That's how the government elicits, our cooperation. And so not only does it violate the rule of law, but implementing a wealth tax when there's, great viable alternatives like cutting spending. There's a lot of failing programs in California that they could cut back on. It is deeply immoral to turn to your citizens and say, I'm going to take your money instead of reducing the spending that I've been putting forward.
And cutting spending, that is a novel idea that I haven't heard a lot of people talk about lately. So what else? I mean, you were telling me beforehand, you got something else that you're working on right now, a book, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I have a book coming out hopefully in the next week or two. It's a self-published book. I have an author's copy on the way so where I can approve the final edits of it. But it's about how progressive economic policies harm the most vulnerable in society. A lot of times, you know, progressive economic agendas are justified, or at least they attempt to justify them by saying they're working to help the little guy. You know, the most vulnerable, the poor, the working class, they claim that they are the champion of those people. And so I decided to write a very short book about, the most hotly debated progressive economic policies and explain how they harm the most vulnerable.
Nice. I love the idea. We've been telling people for a while that they should take the moral high ground, that these people that argue in favor of those policies have taken the moral high ground because they're the ones who want to help, when in fact they're the ones that are hurting. And ideas like what libertarians have are actually the most moral ideas and the best way to help the most amount of people. So love the idea. And you got a name? What's the name of it?
Yeah, so the title is Beyond Intention. The full title is Beyond Intention, How Progressive Economic Policy Initiatives Harm the Most Vulnerable.
Awesome. And you're going to send me a copy when that's finished up, right?
Absolutely. It will be on your doorstep in a nice box, cool, I promise. Cool.
I thought I'd put you on the spot right there. Well, tell everyone where they can go to follow more of your work.
Yeah, you guys can go to Twitter and follow me at Benjamin Iyanian. That's where I post most of my work. I'm also on Instagram at BIyanian13. I tend to post most of it there as well.
Okay. And just so people listening know, it could also be pronounced Iyanian. There's no real way of knowing. So if that helps you with the spelling, you can think about it that way too. Ben, thank you so much for your time today. Had a great time, great conversation, and we'd love to have you back on soon.
Thanks for having me on. It was great talking with you.
Coming up, you all know what time it is. It's time for Dumb Bleep of the Week. Time to get your votes in. If you're in the live group, join gmail.com, the Fed Haters Club. But if not, you'll just have to listen to what everyone else voted for on Liberty at Night in the intro.
If you're concerned about the power grid and want to generate your own supply of off-grid electricity, this will be the most important message you'll hear this year. Here's why. We now have a small number of solar generators back in stock. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving backup power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, solar generators run quietly, emit no dangerous fumes, and produce an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. Whether it's wildfires, dangerous weather, power grid issues, or just getting off the grid, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. Even better, all this week, radio listeners get over $700 in free off-the-grid bonuses, too. Go to mysolarbackup.com to learn more and check availability. That's mysolarbackup.com. Look for the free report, Crisis Cooling, how to make absolutely sure your meat, milk, and medicines stay safe and cool in any power outage. Yours free at mysolarbackup.com.
Complement your health with hemp-derived cannabinoid oil. We've always believed that the closer to Earth, the better it is for our bodies. Our hemp-derived cannabinoid oil is phytocannabinoid-rich, full-spectrum, and organically grown. Finally, hemp made easy, clean, and effective. GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203. That's right, we cut through the red tape. It's now available at GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203.
Looking for that edge during those intimate moments? We see many ads for enhancement, but the side effects include death. At GCN Team, we should change the Healthy Body, Brain, and Heart Pack to the Healthy Libido Pack. The brain and heart are not the only organs that require a healthy vascular system. For proper blood flow at the right moment, go to GCNteam.com or call 877-878-4203. That's 877-878-4203. That's 877-878-4203.